everyone. It's great to see you all here. I hope you've been enjoying the class with David. I am Donna Cease. I'm the Spiritual Programs Coordinator at Kadampa Center. I actually see that Sherry has been very organized and already got on the board here. A couple of things I wanted to tell you about, which is that if you enjoy this class and you want to learn more about Buddhism in general, there's a class called Buddhism in a Nutshell that meets during the daytime starting up this week in a couple of days, not a couple of weeks. And if you're interested in that class in the evening, we'll be starting that up again in February. We're because of the holidays, we're going to take a little break. There's also, if you wanted to go a little deeper into Buddhism, a course called Discovering Buddhism. It's a 2-year cycle of classes, and it covers 13 topics and goes into them in some depth. Each class meets 5, 6, or 7 sessions, depending on how much time it needs to do it justice. And that starts in January. So those are some options. And, of course, we always encourage you to come. If you're interested in learning more, come on Sunday mornings at 10:30. That's when our resident teacher, Geshe Gelug, is here. He's a Tibetan Buddhist monk. He speaks English very fluently, and he teaches at a little deeper level than either of the other classes. And we also tend to have a lot of discussion on Sundays. So I encourage you to explore any of those options if you're interested. I also, this is a meditation class, so you wouldn't have been getting into much in the way of Buddhist concepts, but I'm sure you're all familiar with at least the idea of karma. And one of the concepts in karma, we tend to think of it as, oh, this is my bad karma ripening, or this is my good karma. But also we can control our karma to some extent by the things we choose to do to create good karma for the future. And so, because everything we experience, we caused one way or another. And so we try to do things that will help us to experience results that are like the things that we've done. I'm doing the whole teaching here. didn't mean to do that. But so at Kadampa Center, you know, we just feel so incredibly grateful that we have this opportunity to have these kinds of teachings. And so we want to continue to create the causes to have the teachings here in North Carolina, and we also want to express our gratitude. So on those notes, we have a little offering for David and thanks to him. And I also want to thank Sherry, who's been our ABLE program assistant, and Chris, who's handled the media for you.
Donna, can you say one more word about the Sunday programs? Because we had the question, do we have a children's program?
Oh.
And we do have a children's program.
Yes, we do have a children's program, and it serves children, everything from infants up into teen years. There are 5 different classes. If you're entering it for the first time, then you want to check in with a family program with your kids. The kids start off here in the Gampa for the first little preliminary prayers, and then they go out for their classes. And it's right here on site. There's the nursery is here in this building. Middle school kids meet out here at the table, and there's a classroom, mobile classroom across the other side of the it's not a parking lot, but it used to be a gravel yard. It's kind of a garden now.
Campus, that sounded good.
Yeah. Campus, yes, across. And it's volunteer-driven. Parents are welcome to go with their kids. Sometimes they specifically have it organized so that for a few Sundays, parents will definitely go with their kids. And not, they'll either stay with their kids in the gump or go with their kids to class. Other times, you can send your kids to the class and stay here and hear the teachings from Geshe-la. So it's a nice little mix of things, and we have programs every year. We have a family Dharma camp that just met a few weeks ago, and there's a different topic every time. And this one was out at Camp Agape down in Fuquay Marina. So there's a lot going on. And if you need to know more, I can't tell you all that off the top of my head, but come on a Sunday just before 10:30, and we'll match you up with someone in the program who can tell you more. Or get on our website and look for it and get more information.
Thank you, Donna.
Thank you. Good times, everyone.
Yeah, kind of to reflect a little further on what she was saying, I always think about when I started coming to the center, it was 2004, it was in a basement of an office complex down the road a little ways. And I remember when we moved into this. But I think about the fact that all of this was built on the generosity of the shoulders of people that came before me. And the whole Kadampa community started with just a couple of people meeting in a living room somewhere, and it just kind of kept growing and growing. And this is, I might have mentioned this before, this is one like the only center, or one of the only ones that survived just on donation basis alone rather than paying for the teachings, which is quite miraculous. And as such, it's turned out to be one of the largest centers in the United States too. So I guess that just is part of the whole karmic thing, right? People have kind of paid things forward. So anyway, I'll remind everybody, please put their phone on meditate. Is anybody here for the first time tonight? Okay, welcome. Well, we got a little catching up, but we won't probably do too much. All of the handouts that I've talked about, and we're on handout number 12 now, those are all available on the website. So you can go to the Kadampa website, the Meditation 101 class, and be able to get a hold of those. Has anybody had any trouble getting the handouts at all? So, all right. So we'll start out this evening with just doing a little bit of meditation, and then we'll have some discussion. So if you get yourself, there's a seven posture that I'll talk about, and the handouts on the website that describes that as well. So comfortable on the floor. If you're in a chair, your back straight, your feet flat on the floor. Yeah, your back straight, like a stack of coins maybe. Your hands, whatever is comfortable for you, your hands in your lap or whatever. Your top of your head up a little bit, that allows your chin to drop down. Your eyes closed or maybe slightly open, your preference. And then your tongue at the roof of your mouth, behind your front teeth. And I want you to take a moment and this is session number 5. Think about what motivated you here to come tonight. You had lots of opportunities to do other things, and yet you chose to come here and learn more about how to explore and understand your own mind, which is a remarkable thing to be able to do. So even the interest in being able to do that is remarkable. And then you can add whatever motivation you want to that. And then I want you to just start watching your breath, and I'll do a guided meditation after a bit, but we'll start out with just watching our breath. And when your mind wanders, just gently notice whatever captured your attention, let go of it, and come back to the breath. If your mind has wandered, just gently bring it back to the breath. Now I want you to visualize in the space above your head a little ball of white light, pure, transparent, and formless, a little smaller than the size of your head. Spend a few moments trying to concentrate on the presence of the light. Don't worry if it doesn't appear too sharply, just enough to feel that it's there. Now think about the fact that the sphere of light represents all universal goodness, love, and wisdom, and the fulfillment of your own highest potential. Then visualizing it decreasing in size until it's a small bright sphere about an inch in diameter. This small ball of pure white light descends through the top of your head to your heart center. From there it begins to expand once more, slowly spreading to fill your entire body. As it does, all the solid parts of your body dissolve and become light. Your organs, bones, blood vessels, tissue, skin, all become pure, formless light. Concentrate on the experience of your body as a body of light. think that all problems, negativities, hindrances have completely vanished and you've reached a state of wholeness and perfection. Feel a sense of joy and serenity. If any thought or distracting object appears in your mind, just let it dissolve into the light as well. If you want to, try to expand the ball of light so it completely encompasses you. Again, that represents universal goodness, love, wisdom, and the fulfillment of your highest potential. Then allow the light to grow. The sphere of light to grow even bigger. Maybe encompassing the people next to you. You can allow it to grow to fill the whole room and completely encompass the building. Continue to grow and encompass the neighborhood, the surrounding areas. You can have it grow to completely encompass the whole city or the county. While still representing universal goodness, love, and wisdom. If you choose, you can allow it to grow and cover the entire state, or the hemisphere, or even the entire world. And then just sit with that feeling as long as you can. And again, if things arise, just let them go. Okay, how was that one? Could you hold on to that for a while? Or did your mind kind of dwindle off a little bit and kind of go around? Yeah. It takes some time to be able to kind of hold that for as long as you can. And that's kind of the goal, right, is to get that sense or that feeling. And then, again, that the whole purpose of the focus meditations are to, once you kind of have that sensation, to be able to just hold it for as long as you can. Ideally, as long as you want to, you know, because it evokes a good feeling, right? You feel pretty good about it, for the most part. So if you can hang on to that and intensify it, it can be quite pleasurable. So, any thoughts? How about in general? This is class 5. This is the last one. How are things going at home? Any obstacles, questions, issues, insights? Got a lot of time, Phil, tonight. Does anybody have anything they're challenged with in setting up their own practice at home, or questioned? Yes, sir.
I mean, this is my first time here, but...
Good.
is it easier to meditate in a group than it is at home? Or, like, why does it feel maybe, like, a stronger effect?
In a group?
Yeah.
Has anybody else noticed that? Is it easier to do here than it is to do at home? Okay, a lot of people do. I don't know. Does anybody have any idea why? It's supposedly more powerful, more beneficial, and they do group meditations here. You know, I think there's one Saturday they're going to do for a couple hours Saturday morning. Yes, ma'am.
I think it could be because of the vibration and the energy.
Yeah.
Together and then just feel that and pass it around.
That's good.
That's what I think.
Yeah, I think there's probably a lot of truth to that. Because the collective energy that you kind of form by working together. Some people do better with some guided, structured stuff too, you know. So they find that that helps. Sometimes at home, there might be a tendency to be a little bit more easily distracted by things, you know. I know when you do a retreat, they often, you know, a lot of times you go someplace to do a retreat. Which, you know, if I think about it long enough, it seems like it would be easier at home. You know, I know where everything is. You know, it's kind of set. But you're kind of distracted by things. So that probably has a lot to do with it, too. Anybody else have anything they want to share about that? Does anybody find it easier at home than they do in a group? Not yet, maybe. Okay. Any other thoughts? Chris. Oh.
I work at, or I go out to Caledonia Prison and help guys meditate and just try to get a handle on things and do mindfulness stuff. And when I first got there, I could not meditate. I don't know what it was. I don't think it was being scared, but I just could not meditate.
Mm-hmm.
Probably just because it was such a different atmosphere. But now, after I've been doing it for about 2 years, no problem. Even being in a prison with all these guys that you think you'd be worried about.
Yeah.
Maybe it's just a realization of how hard they all work to try to make their lives better in prison as much as they can. It's no problem at all to just watch your breath or concentrate on a little spot on the floor. And
yeah.
Yeah, it really surprised me that it got way easier after a while.
Right. And it's noisier, too, isn't it?
Oh, my gosh.
They're noisy. Prisons are not quiet places. They're not like monasteries.
We were... I got to tell this story, too. We were in, like, upstairs in the back of Caledonia. There's, like, a computer training room. We were in this, like, little office before the computer training room. Well, they didn't have enough guards because of employee shortages. So they moved us down to, like, this, one of the basic visitation halls.
Mm-hmm.
And constantly, when we're there from 1:30 till 3, they're rolling these big metal carts through there, it sounds like, and doors are slamming, and you really see what it's like to be in prison, how much noise there is all the time.
Yeah, it's very distracting. Yeah.
And that's all I'll say about that. You would not believe how noisy it is in prison. And these guys come, and they seem to be doing okay, because none of them seem to complain too much about how noisy it is, really.
They get used to it.
Yeah, that could be, yeah.
And I know with the kids, when I work with the youth prison, I guess they call it developmental school or something. There's some euphemism for it, a term that they use. The kids will try to evoke something from other kids, right? They're always getting poked at or, you know, nudged or something, you know, to kind of make things more difficult for me. And some of them manage all right through all of that, you know. So, yeah, I think, you know, the setting has a whole lot to do with it. But the more you practice, you know, the noises, the extraneous things, those distractions will kind of take away. And I think the more you develop your own little area at home, you'll be much more comfortable with it over a period of time, you know. So that's kind of your little space that you go to. And you want to kind of set it up like that, too, you know. Over a period of time, you'll get real comfortable there, so. Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
Oh, need the microphone.
So I was here on Sunday, and one of the things that really stuck with me was that a form of meditation that you also discussed a little bit, but is changing a negative thought into a positive.
Mm-hmm.
And every time you do that, it's actually meditation. And I've actually been happier. And even this past week, I'll be driving with a smile on my face for no reason, just because I'm happy.
Oh, there you go.
So it's really cool. And and taking it out of the context of having to, you know, sit in a quiet space, that really even noticing those negative thoughts and challenging them and turning them into positive is a form of meditation, really. And and how often we can really take advantage of that.
Right. Thank you for saying that. Because, you know, we do think of meditation as it's a formal thing, right? We sit here on our cushion and we do our thing and we watch our breath. And initially the purpose of that is to be able to just recognize these thoughts that kind of crop up in our head out of who knows where, right? Who knows where they originate? Thoughts and emotions. So when you become attuned to that, then as you go through your normal day-to-day life, you know, something will happen and you'll start to react to that and you realize, wait a second, here's a moment to be mindful, right? And I can change that. I can change that story that I've created in my head. Instead of the typical route where we just kind of play the record over and over again and make it louder and louder and get more irritated, you know, we can reverse that process. And that's really what it all boils down to, is finding a way to change those negative thoughts into positive, more positive ones. And you get to choose. And it's all within your power, too. You know, that's what people don't realize is... they think all of the bad stuff that happens to me is out there, you know, and they don't realize how much control they have over changing that attitude. You can start to develop, even for people that are really irritating, you can start to develop a sense of compassion for them, you know. It's like they're caught up in something because they're just wanting to be happy too. That's what it boils down to, is everybody's just like you. In terms of wanting to find something that makes them happy. And they don't often have very good skills at doing that. And as a result, they're very irritating to other people. They could be, you know. But you can develop a sense of compassion for them if you dig a little deeper and realize what's going through their head and what they don't realize is going through their head that's causing all their frustration, you know. And that just takes practice. But to your point, you know, there's lots of opportunities to practice. You probably have people and things that irritate you all the time. You know, those are all opportunities. All opportunities out there. So, any other comments or thoughts with their practice? That kind of leads us into the whole discussion, which is more on, you know, how to transform the habitual negative, harmful, and unproductive thoughts into something that's more positive, more patterns. Because we're habituated with this. You know, we've practiced these negative things. Most people say since I was very, very young, you know. If you're Buddhist, you'll say it's been many lifetimes, right? We've been practicing it for a long, 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 long time. And a lot of these things are kind of hardwired into us too, right? We've talked about that before too. We're, you know, our mind just goes to the negative and not as easily to the positive. And that's what we're trying to train our mind to do, kind of change that a little bit. Problems and suffering. So in Buddhism, they'll talk about suffering. You probably heard that. Dukkha, you know, life is suffering. And there's actual suffering, but then there's kind of the more mundane day-to-day suffering that we don't even classify as suffering. You know, things that, the suffering of change. So, you know, the air conditioner goes on and then it gets cold and then the air conditioner cuts off and then after a while it kind of gets warm and then it gets cold it gets warm and you know I have to sit with my legs crossed this way and for a while it's comfortable and I gotta change my legs this way. I can sit for a while and then I gotta stand up, you know. So we're always looking for this change, and a lot of times what we define as happiness is just some sort of change from what was beginning to be uncomfortable. There's a teacher that comes here regularly, and if you get a chance, you want to come and hear Robina. I don't know if anybody's ever seen Robina Corton, Venerable Corton, come. And you can pull her up on YouTube. She's a lot of fun. She's an Australian nun, but she's very easy to understand, and she puts things quite clearly. But she always talks about chocolate cake, and how, you know, we have anticipation that this is going to be good, right, this chocolate cake. And she talks about all the suffering it kind of go along with it. So if we go in a restaurant that's noted for their chocolate cake and we order it and they don't have any, right, we're upset because we're disappointed. Our expectations were not met, you know. So we created that situation ourselves. Or she'll talk about, you know, the first bite is very good, the second bite's not bad, third bite. At some point, you're going to get sick, you know. If the goodness was in the cake, we would never get sick from eating it. We could just keep on eating it. So it's our projection of the goodness, the good and the evil that we put on things out there that create all the problems for us, you know. And those are all things that we can change. So it's our own biases and anticipations. And these are habits. And they talk about in Buddhism, you know, the two kind of base ones. There's three things. And if you'll see some tankas around, it's got a pig, a snake, and a rooster. And I don't remember exactly. The pig, I think, is ignorance. Am I right about that? Well, anyway, one of them is ignorance. We won't talk too much about that right now. Then there's aversion or hatred, or those things that we don't want. And then there's attachment, which are those things that we're kind of drawn to. Right? And so we go through life wanting things that we're drawn to and wanting to avoid the things that we dislike, you know. But these are just biases that we've, and labels that we've placed on things. I think we've talked about mushrooms and broccoli. Did I talk about that before? Some people love mushrooms. Some people hate mushrooms, you know. But it's not built into the mushroom. It's just all our perception or however we put it on there. Broccoli is another good example. Bileweed. So these things are, again, based on our habits, aversions, and attachment. And they say that it's rooted in a self-centered mind, right? The world kind of evolves and revolves around me. This is my story. You're all actors in my story. And if you don't act the way I would expect you to act, then you're a bad actor, and I'll label you as such, right? We have these things. I came across this this definition. Has anybody heard of naive realism? Probably may have heard of that before. So it's actually interesting. It's a psychological term. The short of it is, we think we see reality as it really is, objectively and without bias. Okay. The facts are plain for all to see, that any rational person would agree with me, and that people that don't agree with me are either uninformed, lazy, irrational, or biased. Right? Would anybody disagree with that statement? I mean, there's a whole lot more of a definition of this. I see entities and events as they are in objective reality, and that my social attitudes, beliefs, preferences, priorities, and the like follow from a relatively dispassionate, unbiased, and essentially direct comprehension of the information and evidence at hand. Yeah, I do that. That's me. That other rational people generally will share my reactions, behaviors, and opinions, provided that they've had access to the same information that gave rise to my views, and provided that they too have processed that information in a reasonably thoughtful and open-minded fashion. Sure. Anybody disagree? So far, we're all on the same page, right? Do you see where this is going? Failure of a given individual or group to share my view arises from one of three possible sources. The first one is, the individual in question or group may have been exposed to a different sample of information than I was, in which case, provided that the other party is reasonable and open-minded, the sharing or pooling of the information should get them to believe the same thing that I do or agree with me. Secondly, the individual group in question may be lazy, irrational, or otherwise unable or unwilling to proceed in a normative fashion from objective evidence to a reasonable conclusion. Or the individual group in question may be biased, either in interpreting the evidence or in proceeding from evidence to conclusions by ideology, self-interest, or some other distorted personal influence. We all think that way. And yet, it doesn't work that way. You know? So So by cracking that belief, and it's easy to sit and think about that and realize that, yeah, I don't see the world the same way everybody else does. And it's all right for me to sit here on my cushion and think that, but as soon as I get up, my mind goes right back to that way of thinking. So the idea, ideally, we would be able to recognize the fallacy. They call this ignorance in Buddhism, right? That we all have this kind of inherent ignorance of reality. So my goal would be to see things as they really are, which means I have to shatter this whole self-image of myself or belief in what I think is right. And that's hard to do. I mean, we can do it at times and we can do it with certain circumstances, but generally speaking, to be able to let go of that self-centered view is very, very difficult. You know, we've practiced it for so long. And that's where all of our biases and aversions and attractions all kind of come out of that view of the way I think reality is, my naive view of reality. So, I've got a lot of work. A lot of work. You know, it's like a non-stop job is to kind of break that view of the way I see things. But it's not impossible, and there's nothing else for me to do, right? That's kind of it. And I feel very, very fortunate to be able to say, my view is wrong, you know? Because a lot of people wouldn't be able to think that way, that I could possibly be wrong. So that's, you know, humility is kind of the basis of that, is to be able to recognize that, wow, my view might be wrong. And so when those things pop up in our head, you know, if I'm sitting in a meeting and somebody says something and I think, oh, you know, he's a jerk. So I can say, wait a second. You know, I can catch myself. The first thing that comes in my head is he's a jerk. Now, if I've practiced, or if I'm partially civilized, I can at least keep that thought in my head and not let it spew out of my mouth. Some people, it'll just kind of come out of their mouth, right? But if I can keep it bottled up, that makes me somewhat civilized. But that doesn't necessarily make me any happier. That doesn't make me any less frustrated with the situation. Okay, I just keep corking it. But if I can start changing that thinking, then that can change a whole lot of things. You know? What do y'all think? Anybody want to challenge any of that? Or say something? I've got another 45 minutes. I've got two meditations that will take up some time, but still.
That's a topic I struggle with a little bit because of my education. So when I'm consulting, I have a lot of scientific background and knowledge of what is proven to be a fact. And I've really struggled with this since gaining all of that knowledge and when I'm consulting. And so a good reminder that I used to think that kind of came back around as I've been doing this stuff is that people are just behaving what they know and what they've learned and really stepping outside of myself and to give it time. And that, you know, and that's completely changed it for me. You know,
to give them time?
Yep. Well, to think they are just behaving in what they know and what they've learned, you know,
right.
And that's completely, and I used to think along those lines before and I kind of lost it and now it's come back around. But that's made things a lot more peaceful and not so tumultuous in how I frankly try to consult. Not that I come in there yelling like, do it my way.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm a lot more compassionate and empathetic about why they approach things the way they do and why they see value and what they're suggesting. And even though what I know might be scientifically extremely valid, it's more me stepping back, seeing what they need, and then meeting them where they're at.
What kind of consulting do you do? This don't mind me asking, sorry.
No, no, not at all. I'm a behaviorist by training, and so a lot of...
Kyle Proud and Eminem, right?
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry.
So now I'm mostly do consulting with businesses and employee engagement and looking beyond performance issues with employees and think about it on a broader scope. But I used to do behavior therapy with kids and stuff as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
So, yeah, so you begin to develop empathy, right? Which is kind of, you know, you stop and think that the person is looking at things differently. And it really softens things a lot. You know, it kind of softens your approach. And you might be wrong, which is kind of an interesting thing too, you know. We might see things. We probably do. If I set a beach ball in the middle, you know, we'd all see different color of beach ball stripe. It doesn't mean we're not all looking at the same beach ball. You know, we just all come from a different, we just have a different come from, a different ontogeny, you know, that's kind of brought us to this moment and all that history that we've drug along with us.
So, I have a question.
Oh, get away from the microphone.
So, in a situation where a person is studying, so, like me, as an example, and I started, you know, studying this and started kind of being fascinated with Buddhism and seeing things for what it is. And but then today I saw myself like completely going back, you know, like after all of this practice and like being tolerable of this person that it was just complaining about everything and talking about everybody else. And then but then I'm thinking, I walk away and said, okay, enough. I can't be around this person anymore. But then I realized that I was doing the exact same thing by talking about her with my husband.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then so that gave me some insight.
Yeah.
I was like, whoa. And then so I think that, you know, kind of like this principle allows you to actually go back, like really, and look at yourself. And,
yeah.
And like you said, like, I am wrong. You know, I'm just putting into the perspective of
right.
So, but the question really is, how do you deal with, you know, as you're working through this and the people around you, that your community, it's they're not doing the same kind of mind work that you do, and kind of how do you go by accepting? I don't know if it's accepting is the right term, or by tolerating is the right term, or not imposing. What what are you learning, you know? Because if they're not ready, you're not teaching them, or I don't know how to exactly say that. But
right.
I
think so. So, you know, first, I think we have to remind ourselves that, you know, this is a practice, and we're all at different stages. And it's funny, because what might not irritate me, might irritate somebody else. And yet I find that they're very comfortable with something that irritates me. So, you know, there's those kind of differences that exist out there. Patience and tolerance are heavily emphasized in this practice. So, you know, being patient with people, being patient with yourself, being tolerant of people, being accepting of yourself and where you're coming from. It's sometimes hard not to teach, but sometimes the best way to teach is just by setting the example, you know. The goal in this particular type of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, is the Mahayana belief is the goal of enlightenment is to help all other sentient beings become enlightened, all right? So so ideally, we ultimately, the goal would be to help other people. But it's sometimes tricky because we're often thinking, it's easy to think that we're further ahead than others, but we're really still in the soup, you know? So, yeah, it's, you know, you want to save somebody else, but, you know, Sometimes they'll say it's like in when you take a flight, right, if the oxygen things fall down, put your own on first before you try to help people around you. So that's kind of the goal with Mahayana Buddhism. But it's difficult not to kind of jump in. And I think that sometimes you just find that there's certain people that are just negative. And it doesn't do my mind any good to be with those people for any length of time, especially if I'm not yet able to feel compassion for them. You know, if it's just the negativity, if it's just my negative voice outside me going, you know, it might help me to kind of be away from those people for a little bit. So, I don't know. I don't know if I answered any of the questions at all, but that's why they call it a practice. You know, it's just an ongoing thing. And it can be quite frustrating sometimes, but again, it's just a matter of being patient with yourself and kind of working a little bit.
I have a question about your thought about observing the others and trying to understand them. I came here in an exchange program, so I'm from another culture. And when I came here, I was like, oh, I want to understand their culture, their everything. And then I was too much open to everything. And then I realized that all of these, I kind of lose it myself. So how could I have this balance, you know, just like, I want to understand the others, I want to respect them, but I don't want to lose myself in the middle.
Wow. I don't know. Has anybody got any thought about that? So you don't want to lose your own self-identity. Did I understand right?
Yes.
But still be open to other people.
Respect them, but having my limits.
Yeah, can you give me an example? Or no? That wouldn't be fair, maybe.
I don't know. I think that in the beginning, much more communication. So, for example, to respect that people do not communicate the way I communicate.
All right.
Just like not talking every time is okay for them, not for me, or... I don't know, this kind of cultural difference.
Uh-huh.
But then I realized that if I jump into this cultural difference, I was going too much outside my world.
Right.
So I tried to understand people, understand that they were being good with me because this is how they were born, how they were created through society. But I realized that this was also... I was trying to respect them, but I was also not being fair with me.
Okay. Yes, there's somebody back there that might be able to...
I am in the same case because I moved here 2 years ago, and what I can say is be open until the extent you feel comfortable. You don't have to force yourself into anything because otherwise you will not be enjoying the experience. Because I think you came here because of the experience, I mean, for the cultural exchange. But I think you need to listen to yourself and you will know, trust yourself that you will know until what point you can be open. And that gives the other people that sense of you being respectful with yourself, then the other people is going to respect you.
Thank you. That sounded pretty good. Anybody else want to add something to that?
I think what you both just said has a lot to do with what David has been talking about in trying to practice your meditation skills in real life, because you're actually trying to behave and react in a way that's different than you've been accustomed to for a very, very long time. And so as you try that out, you may feel uncomfortable, just as you are experiencing when you're trying to experience another culture, but it's not familiar to you. So I think this all happens slowly, and as you can cope with it and as you feel comfortable, because no one wants to lose themselves immediately. I mean, you gradually learn where your boundaries are, what tolerances you develop, and how you can experience other people's experiences and lives. So I guess it's just a process.
Yeah, and you know, Mike, I don't know, because I haven't had that, the fortune or misfortune, however you want to look at it, of having the experience of living in another culture. But I know from a humanity standpoint, everybody wants the same thing, right? They want the same thing that you do in terms of happiness. So that gives us all kind of a common framework on which to at least begin working. We had a compassion class here a few months back that was a 10-week program. It was pretty good. And it came out of California, Center for Altruism and Compassion. But they're kind of the mantra was just like me, right? Everybody's just like me. They want the same thing. They want the happiness, the same thing that I want. It may be packaged different. It may sound different. It may look a little different, but they still want the same thing. And she said if we kept kind of going back to that, that gives us some groundwork on which we're all kind of standing. Everybody wants that level of happiness. And I know the Dalai Lama talks about that the same, talks about it also, is that, you know, we all want that same thing. So that I find that reassuring. I don't often think that way, and have to kind of remind yourself of that on occasions. But again, if I see somebody doing something that just doesn't make any sense to me at all, why they thought that would make them any happier, you know, I chalk it up to the fact that they've got, you know, they suffer from the naive realism, but they just are seeking happiness. They just aren't going about it the same way that I would. And I begin to feel a little empathy and a little compassion for the other person. And then that kind of creates some space that you can begin kind of working in a little bit. So, I don't know. Anybody else have anything they want to ask or bring up? We've got a couple more meditations if you want to do those. These are both guided meditations. And again, one of them, the last one I'll do isn't in the handouts, but it's something you'll be able to do on your own. This is on equanimity. So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about friends, enemies, and strangers. So if you can kind of preemptively think about someone who you might label as a dear friend, someone you might label as an enemy, if you have someone or someone you have some aversion towards, and then just a stranger, someone you might have seen but you don't really know. All right, and we'll just go ahead and get comfortable and sit in your meditation posture. And focus your meditation, or focus your attention on your breath. Allow your mind to kind of settle in to the moment. And try to become a little bit more, develop a concentrated state if you can. So the intention of this meditation is to overcome some of our self-centered bias and judgments, and to develop a mind of equanimity and balance towards other people. Imagine in the space in front of you there are three people. Someone you like, someone you dislike, and someone to whom you feel indifferent. Kind of keep those three people in your mind throughout this meditation. First, I want you to focus on your friend. allow your feelings for that person to rise strongly. Feel your conviction that this person is definitely and truly a friend. That as a person is good to you, fulfills your needs and wishes. And think about how you really want this person to be happy. And identify with those good feelings that you have. Now shift your attention to the person you dislike or someone you might label as your enemy. This is a person, again, who you dislike. They're not kind to you. They don't satisfy your needs. They may annoy you, make you angry. They may hurt you. Think about this person carefully. Look carefully at the feelings that you have about that person. Finally, shift your attention to the so-called stranger. This is a person that you barely know, but whom you neither like nor dislike. Look carefully at that person. And notice your feelings of indifference. Now think about and recognize that the nature of your relationship with each of these three people and the labels you've put on each of them are based solely on what they do or don't do for you at this particular point in time. Think about someone or people who have been your friend, but then became your enemy. And vice versa. Someone who is your enemy and then became your friend. Or think about strangers who then became friends or enemies. Each of these labels is temporary and impermanent. It's just on what the situation is at the time. Move your attention back to your friend and imagine a situation that would cause that friendship to end. Imagine your friend turning against you. Experience the resentment and anger and hurt that you would feel in such a situation. Do you still feel warm, friendly feelings towards this person? Do you still wish him or her well and want that person to be happy? Where is your, quote, friend now? Remember that this person was not your friend before you were acquainted. Recognize how easily this person could cease to be your friend now, just as you've imagined. Think to yourself that there's no sound reason for feeling kind and loving toward only the friend at this moment. Relationships have changed in the past and will continue to change. Today's friend can become tomorrow's enemy. Now move your attention to the present enemy. Imagine a situation in which you could be drawn together and become close. Maybe a common interest, a word of praise or kindness. Look at that person and your feelings towards them very carefully. Are those feelings softening a bit, becoming warmer? You can learn to feel warmly toward your enemies. It's happened before and will happen again. Why do we hold so strongly to the concept that this person is definitely an enemy? Now move your attention to the stranger. Imagine how one act of kindness or anger from this person could immediately turn him or her to a friend or an enemy, respectively. There is no inherent, definite stranger there. There is no sound reason for the feelings of indifference that we hold to them. Remember that your present friend and your present enemy were both strangers to you beforehand. And this enemy could become a friend or an enemy now. Maintain your awareness of these three people in front of you. Think about the fragile impermanence of these relationships. It's only your misconceived belief in the concreteness of these labels, friend, enemy, and stranger, that holds your mind back from possibility of change and fluidity. Your friend, enemy, and stranger all want happiness just as much as you do in that respect. In that way, we're all equal. Also, everyone is equal in having the potential to develop their minds to the fullest extent and achieve ultimate clarity and compassion. The differences that we see in people are superficial, based only on our mistaken and narrow self-centered views. In fact, everyone is equal in deserving our care and compassion. And none of this means that we should not discriminate at all. On a practical level, our ability to distinguish between actions and individuals is necessary. And naturally, we feel closer to some people who are wise to keep our distance from others. This is not in any way contradictory to the meditation we've just done. The point of the meditation is to develop equal concern, equal regard for everyone, for their well-being, whether they help or harm us at this point in time, and to see that the labels that we put on others are often arbitrary, mistaken, and very changeable. Any thoughts on that meditation? Were you able to go through and shuffle people around a little bit? No. Some. Sometimes it's easier to do with people that we don't have real strong feelings towards. You know? Friend light and enemy light. Were some of you able to move them around? See where things could change? I mean, they change all the time. Yeah. They're like broccoli and mushrooms.
I had a interesting moment. I had an enemy in mind from, you know, several years back who I was thinking about why I didn't like this person. And the things that I tell myself why I don't like them, I realized are qualities that I don't mind in another person who I consider a friend.
Huh.
So I compared those two people, and what I realized was that the enemy I had feelings of jealousy and competition towards, whereas I didn't have jealousy and competition with the friend. But they flipped.
So oh, interesting. Yeah. That's good. Thank you. Yeah, it is kind of just minor stuff, isn't it, that differentiates. jealousy and envy are two pretty powerful afflictive emotions, you know? You think about that. We do some of the training we do, we look at those two things. We talked about delight. I might have mentioned that once before. It's a hard concept for us to understand, but it's the opposite of being jealous of somebody or being envious of somebody. Actually feeling good that somebody else got that promotion or whatever, you know? Our minds don't go there naturally, you know, but we can make them go there. We would want someone to feel happy for us if something happened. Good. Yeah. Competition's a tough thing. Collaboration is much better. Anybody else have any thoughts on that meditation? That's one that's easy to practice. It's an analytical one you can kind of go through on your own pretty easily because you know how to set it up, you know. And just spend time doing that. Spend time doing that with somebody that, again, is not, it's not too far, you know. Maybe not too, you don't feel too strongly of a negative feeling towards, you know. It makes it a little easier.
I didn't choose someone that I hated, but someone
there you go.
Who has kind of competing interests for me at work. Just kind of reminding myself that, you know, not to take it personally. And a common kind of mantra I have is people aren't doing things to you, they're doing things for themselves. And so kind of
right.
That, was it naive realism?
Yeah, naive realism.
Yeah, they're not doing things to you, they're doing things for themselves. And so kind of reflecting on how our interests are kind of at a mismatch, but that doesn't necessarily mean that I need to dislike that person.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Our teacher here told me once, he says, it's really kind of surprising we get along as well as we do. And I thought, yeah, that's probably true. We think about that enough, you know. We're just kind of all randomly, we're like bumper cars, just randomly whacking into each other. I'm just trying to get around the course, you know. People are in my way, going the wrong direction, whatever. You know. And everybody's just kind of, everybody's got that naive realism. Everybody's kind of sees themselves as the center of the universe, and they're just trying to get through life with themselves. There was a saying, "What be kind to people because we don't know what battles or what war they got going on or something like that." I'm by set up. I'm sorry, but you know, everybody's fighting a terrible battle that we have no idea about, right? So, and that's so true, but we don't think that way. Thank you. That was good. Anybody else have a comment? Or thoughts? Get one more meditation, one more analytical one. 8:12, got a couple minutes. We'll talk after this one. All right, so last one. Get yourself comfortable. This isn't one of the handouts. I had read this somewhere just like it. So, so take a few minutes to just kind of allow your breathing to, your attention to focus on your breath. And the purpose of this meditation, again, to kind of set your motivation, we're going to look at impermanence again. Things changing moment by moment. A lot of what Buddhism says, our ignorance is based on the fact that we see things as permanent. Now imagine you're sitting here in the Gampa. And a person walks in the door up front. And it's you. but it was you either 10, 15, 20 years ago, a young version of you. And they walk over and sit down across from you. And you strike up a conversation. What might they tell you? And what might you tell them? What kind of advice would you share? Would you like that person, and would they like you? Now imagine the door opens again and another person walks in, and it's you 20 years in the future. And they sit down across from you and you have a conversation with that person. What might you tell that person, and what might they tell you? Would you like each other? Now the door opens one more time, and there's an old person with a cane. And it's you at 95. And they slowly walk over and sit down. What kind of conversation might that be? What would be your feelings towards that person, and what would be their feelings towards you? Okay, any thoughts about that one? That's kind of a sombering one. Yes.
I thought that was really interesting, because when we were doing the one before, it occurred to me that I was pretty much all three, like the person that I'm fond of, the person I'm angry at.
Oh, really?
And the person I really don't know yet sometimes.
Oh, wow, that's good.
And then, so it was quite coincidental that you did that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I thought it was very interesting.
Okay.
To then do it again.
Yeah, so. Thank you. I hadn't had anybody share that with me yet, but that's good. Anybody else have any thoughts about that meditation? Yes, sir.
It's
20-year older self told my current self to not stop meditating. Don't stop meditating.
Oh, don't stop meditating. Oh, good, good.
That was the first thing that came
up. Heed that advice. Yeah. The 95-year-old one says that too. It's an interesting little game. I used to do this. I picture myself at 95, and then I try to go back in time, right? What would that person look like at my current age? Yeah. Never quite matched that. But it was a good kind of thought thing going. Any other comments or thoughts? 8:20. We had 5 weeks together. You know, I would encourage you just kind of stick with it, you know. It'll be easy. It is easy to kind of fall out of the habit of doing this very easily, right? You look around at the number of folks that have stuck through the 5 weeks based on, I don't know how many folks we had here the first night. We have 40 or something, maybe? It was pretty, we had a lot of people. Yeah. I mean, and that's fine. And things come up, and I'm not, you know, I don't know what would cause people to stop necessarily, but to stick through it is really a good thing. It's a good start. So you've got a little momentum. You want to kind of keep the wheels spinning and keep working. Try to just expand your meditation a little bit on a regular basis. You know, if you think about, you can pull that definition of naive realism I got off of Wikipedia, naive realism psychology. If you think about that long enough, you realize, wow, what else is there to do but kind of get rid of that? Right? That's kind of it. Once I got rid of that, then everything's okay. That's what happiness is. I mean, that's on a Buddhism level. That's what happiness is. Emptiness, they call emptiness. To kind of negate our own self-centered view of the way the world is and realize it's nothing like that. It's all impermanent, constantly in flux, interconnected. What was the thing I saw about I've got a little app on my phone called WeCroak. And it's a Bhutan practice that five times a day they remind themselves they're going to die. With the idea, and there's a lot of death meditation is a big thing in Buddhism because it makes you really appreciate life if you realize that, you know, wow, tomorrow's not promised to anyone, and if you're constantly reminded of that. But, you know, pops up and says, don't forget, you're going to die. And it's kind of morbid at first, but, you know, I've gotten used to it. But they have little quotes with it that are really kind of quite powerful. We croak, yeah, it's got a little frog. It's a good little app. But one of the quotes was it, Zen pretty much boils down to this. Everything's impermanent, we're all connected, pay attention. You know? And I thought, yeah, that's pretty much what it all boils down to. You know? So, you know, if you can remind yourself that on a regular basis, and that's kind of the whole goal of this, right? Is just to kind of keep reminding yourself. Because as soon as you get off of your cushion, you forget it. You know, you hang on to it for a little while, but, you know, you kind of drift back into your old mode of thinking, and it just takes a long time to kind of overcome that, which is fine. There's nothing else to do. You know, just breathe.
One question.
Yes? We got to wait for the... sorry. For those listening at home.
This last meditation, I felt so sad to see me 20 years ago.
In the past?
I kind of miss that person, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm from another country too, and I felt me, I saw me there, and I was like, oh my God, that was me 20 years ago. I felt so sad.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that meditation evokes all sorts of feelings for people, you know, it tends to. But, you know, you can look ahead and say, I have opportunity here, you know. What was the other saying? The best time to plant a shade tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is today. So Yeah, so try to stick with it. Try to make it a habit. You'll do it. And you'll have down times too. You know, have times like you'll sit and I think, I just can't get focused, or I can't do this, and you end up getting pulled away. But those times become fewer and fewer, and you start missing it if you don't spend your few minutes, whatever that amounts to, on a regular basis, you know. And that's where it really starts getting good, when you start to miss it and you really look forward to it. So, all right, 8:26. We got done early. Nobody else has anything else. That's kind.
I do have a question.
Oh, yes, please. Microphone.
So for the meditation practice, I normally just sit and do silent meditation,
uh-huh,
and then just focus on my breath. But then coming here, you know, and learning about all of these other, like, wonderful meditations, just pretty much grab a text from the handouts and then read that up before you meditate?
Is
that how you would suggest?
Yeah, that'd be perfect. So, like this one on equanimity, you know, it's broken. And this, I think this one came out of, might have come out of Kathleen McDonald's book on how to meditate too. The one earlier, the Body of Light one did. This one did also. So, it's broken in paragraphs. So, you know, imagine your friend, the first paragraph. And so, I might, if it's a new text, I might sit and relax, focus my mind, and then I would read that, and then I would try to do that in my head. And then I might, you know, hold on to that for as long as I can. Then I might read the next paragraph and try to meditate on that for as long as I can. That would be one way to do it. You can get recordings that you could listen to, mm-hmm, you know, or you could read it yourself and record it and just play it back. There's a number of ways that you can do that. And you'll find things. Like, there's lots of books and texts that, there's a book that a lot of people here read called the Lam Rim. It's kind of the base textbook that we use here a lot. But it's got lots of just things in there, meditations. There's a whole bunch of stuff on death meditation, on impermanence, on karma. So, you know, you might read some of that and then just kind of sit with it a little bit. And it doesn't have to be, you know, sit for 20 minutes with my eyes closed. You know, you kind of hold on to it for as long as you can and kind of get that feeling. And then when it starts to fade, read it again or read something else. And at some point you'll be able to think, oh, equanimity. I'll just practice some equanimity today and do meditation. And I can, you know, I can just do the friend, enemy, stranger, kind of play around with that, do those things without reading it at some point. So, yeah, you'll get it. But anything else? And I think my email is Dave. I've never, I just got it the other day and I've never gotten anything. So I think it's Dave at Knopf Center. I'm also, You can always send to dmaclis@gmail.com if you have a question or something like that. Feel free to tell me who you are so it doesn't go into spam or I don't just kind of blow you off. But stay sat in a class. If you have a question, I'd be happy to try to answer. And there's lots of folks here that have practiced and are able to teach the Discovering Buddhism. They'll go through more. Buddhism in a nutshell. I better not quote me on that one, but that might be it. I think there's a dash something in there, Chris. Kadampa-center.org.
Probably.
Yeah, probably.
I'm going to write the other one down.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, through the dmaclis@gmail.com.
That's easy. It's easy for me anyway, but Dave might be easier for someone else. Doesn't know my last name. Yeah, that might be a problem if there's more than one Dave ever starts working.
Your phone number,
yeah, then I'll ignore that one for certainly. Well, you leave me a message, I'll listen to the voicemail and get back to you. So, yeah, but you know, if you have questions, feel free. There's lots of material around. the books that we have out here. And there's YouTube. Jill wanted me to mention that too. You know, pull up some of the stuff on YouTube, and that you'll find some meditations and some conversations that will lead into meditations that you can kind of work on. The whole bottom line is you're trying to change your mind into more positive and be happier. So if it works, you're on the right track. Okay? All right. Thank you all. Take care. I've enjoyed having you, and I'm sure we'll see you around.
This was great. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to Sherry and Chris.